The Tom Woods Show, episode 2002.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Our old friend Mark Skousen is back on the show with us today. Mark created Freedom Fest, which is, of course, the big liberty gathering normally in Las Vegas. Last year, it was in South Dakota for obvious reasons. But returning to Vegas this year, 2021, Mark is also the publisher of Forecasts and Strategies, his investment newsletter, which he's published for several decades now. He's the author of many books. He's a professor of economics at Chapman University. He's also taught at Columbia Business School. And I might mention that the most recent Freedom Fest was hosted by our friend Dave Smith. That was Mark's decision. We're going to have Dave Smith host the whole thing. That was great for Freedom Fest. That was great for Dave. It says something about Mark Skousen. And I'll tell you something, we've dined out with Mark and Joanne, his wife, together a couple of times in recent months. And each time we've been out for dinner, the dinner has gone on for at least 3 hours. Nonstop, intense conversation. And he was saying to me through email, hey, we have to have dinner again soon, you know, before Christmas time. I'm thinking, I don't know if I have the energy, frankly. But I absolutely love it, honestly. And I can't wait for us to be able to make those arrangements. Mark, welcome back.
Well, good to be with you, Tom. It's been a pleasure to be a part of your podcast for a number of times. And you're doing a great job. And congratulations on hitting 2,000 podcasts.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Yeah, that was quite a milestone. So I want to talk to you about a topic that you are, I think, kind of known for, because you know, you obviously have at least one foot firmly planted in the Austrian camp in terms of economic theory, and you wrote an important book, The Structure of Production, that's entirely Austrian. But you're also known as an investor, and you've had your investment newsletter, Forecasts and Strategies, for over 40 years now. Wait, can that be right? Is it over 40 years?
Yeah, I got started when Ronald Reagan was elected president in late 1980, right after that. And it was fortuitous because the Reagan era kind of reversed the bearish trend in the stock market and in the bond market. So it was definitely a turning point. And that's when I got my newsletter started. So it was a baptism of fire in many ways, because I came out of the gold bug era. My very first investment was a silver dollar after reading Harry Brown's book on the coming monetary crisis.
Okay. All right. So that has been quite a while. So we want to talk about bulls versus bears today. Now, obviously, in some circumstances, everybody's a bear, you know, or in some circumstances, almost everybody's a bull. So it's not like everybody has to pick one. It sort of depends on circumstances. But nevertheless, there are some people who are known as perma bears, who just seem to be always down on the prospects for the market. And on the other hand, maybe you have people, I don't know if you have the exact contrast of that among perma bulls, but I suppose such people probably exist. I don't think you would place yourself into either of those camps.
I think over time I've become more of a perma bull, but with my Austrian background, I recognize that bull markets don't die a natural death. They are killed. They are murdered. This is a line that I quote frequently from my book, The Maxims of Wall Street. And what I mean by that is that, as Austrian economists know, the government's constantly intervening in the economy, especially in the monetary sphere. And when they engage in easy money, it sets up a pattern that eventually they have to adopt tight money if they want to control inflation at all. And so you do get a boom-bust cycle. You do get bull and bear phenomenon in the marketplace. So I've tried to play both sides of this market, but I think the real debate is between perma bears and perma bulls. And you're right, there are perma bulls out there who are recommending stocks no matter what is happening. The latest example is James Glassman, who wrote a book called Dow 36,000, back in 1999 and said it could happen at any time. Now, the Dow had just turned to 10,000 at that time in 1999, and he was now predicting that within a few years, it would reach 36,000. Well, it only reached 36,000 today or this week. And that is a milestone. There's no question about it. His prophecy was finally fulfilled, but he's definitely a perma bull. And in fact, he just wrote this week, he doubled down on his prediction, and he's now predicting Dow 1 million. And so he's a perma bull. And I don't really fit into that camp. I'm skeptical of these kinds of predictions because so much depends on what government policy is. And we have been, the United States is famous in leading the world in encouraging entrepreneurship. And the entrepreneurs come to the United States and they create these fantastic companies. You know, Elon Musk, a perfect example of a man from South Africa who is now the richest man in the world, but he's an American now. He's not really a South African. And what's really interesting is that Elon Musk, in his net worth, it now exceeds the entire GDP of his country of South Africa. So that's a pretty amazing statistic. And, you know, I think you have to be an optimist overall rather than a pessimist, unless there's some evidence that the U.S. is no longer this entrepreneurial wonderland that attracts the best and the brightest from around the world.
Well, now that brings up a point that you kind of were getting at in one of your emails to me about if you look at how the markets in Canada and Japan have done in recent years, you wouldn't be all that happy if you had just gone all in there. So it's not a matter of the stock market in the abstract. It has to be a stock market within the context of a particular kind of regime, I suppose?
Or country, a country fund. So in the case of Canada, stock market looked pretty good in Canada up until 2011. The stock index was at an all-time high. But then it went through a 9-10 year bear market, mainly because their commodity-oriented country with energy and mining as their primary sources of in the stock market, their stock index, they had a pretty long, almost a secular bear market. It's recovering now. Japan is even worse. Japan topped out in 1989 at 30,000 on the Nikkei, and is here it is, what, 30 years later, and they're still struggling to reach all-time highs again. They're recovering, but it's nothing like the U.S. market. So there is American exceptionalism in the marketplace and in our, maybe in the stock market more than anything else. We're the best performing stock country fund in the world over the last 122 years since 1900. And so there's a book that came out called Triumph of the Optimist, where 34 countries were examined in their country funds. And there's only 34 countries where you had a stock market that was open most of the time for those 100 years of the 20th century. And the U.S. outperformed them all. And then you look from 2000 to 2022, this last 22 years, and the American economy, this not the economy, but the stock market, Wall Street has outperformed all other country indexes. So American exceptionalism is alive and well. And the real question mark is whether it will continue or not.
Well, of course, that is a big question. But let's go into a little bit of the theory here, because as you pointed out, a lot of people who are formed by Austrian economics in terms of the way they think about the economy tend to be bearish. The thing is, I can see why they might say, well, you know, the Federal Reserve is doing such and such to the economy, and this distorts investment decisions, and it leads in the long run to economic problems. Now, is the issue between you and them not so much that you disagree with that analysis, but you disagree with exactly how long that long run is? I mean, am I supposed to sit out, what, for 10 years and just not make any gains because at some point there's going to be a crash? So what exactly is your criticism?
So I think you have to look at the history here, and particularly Mises and Hayek. who made their reputation for predicting the 1929 crash and the Great Depression. And it's interesting that the basis of their argument, especially Mises in his Misesian or Austrian theory of the business cycle, which he wrote about in his book on money and credit initially, he made the point that if the government adopts an easy money policy, which they clearly did in the 1920s, it creates an artificial boom in certain sectors, especially the capital intensive sectors that I talk about in the structure of production and Mises talked about in his book and Hayek and so forth. So as early as 1926, we have evidence that Mises was saying the stock market is overvalued, that there's going to be a great smash, as he called it. He'd go by the Credit Anstalt, the biggest bank in Vienna. And as he walked by, he would point to it and say, someday there's going to be a great smash. And I don't want to be a part of it. He was actually considered to be hired by the bank as their chief economist. And he turned it down because he didn't want to be associated with the bank that was going to go bankrupt and eventually did go bankrupt in the early 1930s. And that started the depression in Europe. So that was his prediction. He just was never comfortable with the era of prosperity, always thought it was artificial. And so you see the American Austrian economists kind of adopting that same point of view. Mises was always a pessimist. And of course, it's in Hayek as well. It's the road to serfdom. They had been through hyperinflation, two world wars, and a Great Depression. So no wonder they were depressed. But they were not able to ever overcome this depressing attitude. And I think the students, you know, Mises is regarded, you have the Mises Institute. Mises is kind of the modern face of the Austrian school. So I think it has affected tremendously. I mean, you and I both knew Murray Rothbard. Rothbard was a pessimist. He was extremely critical of Reagan. He never did understand the stock market recovery under Reagan, the economic recovery. He was critical of supply-side economics. He never did see the benefits the reversal, the turning of the tide under Reagan, and even under Thatcher. Hayek revised his road to serfdom and said, it's still true. I'm still pessimistic, he said in his preface to his a new edition of The Road to Serfdom. So the gold bugs, I was part of that. Jim Blanchard's group, the New Orleans Conference. You had Howard Ruff, you had Harry Brown, Jerome Smith. There's a huge list. And today you have Peter Schiff's of the world. You have Robert Kawasaki of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, all of them constantly focusing on this bearish tone that essentially the economy and the stock market are artificially stimulated, they're artificially overvalued, and that eventually there is a reckoning. So I've been on this debate for many years. I was probably the only person at the New Orleans conference in 1980, which occurred right after Reagan was elected. And I was just astonished at this conference that everybody was negative about Reagan winning. There was no happiness at all about this victory by Reagan. And I wrote a promotion piece in 1981 for my newsletter that had just gotten started. The promotion said, the financial shock of 1981. And you open up the envelope and it says, Reaganomics will work, sell your gold and silver and buy stocks and bonds. So that was an accurate prediction, but nobody believed it. And the promotional piece failed miserably, but I was proven to be right. It was a contrarian point of view because everybody, I mean, you had Howard Ruff with a book that had just come out in 1980 called How to Prosper During the Coming Bad Years. Well, it turned out to be the good years. His timing was way off. The bad years were in the 70s. The 1980s were an era of recovery, and the stock market took off, and the bond market. And look, the bond market has been in a 40-year bull market. Even I didn't think that would happen. And the stock market's been in a 40-year bull market as well. So the perma bears have been discredited, to be honest with you, but they're still there. I mean, you've got Peter Schiff and Robert Kawasaki and Doug Casey and others. I mean, Doug Casey himself even admits that he's been wrong for 40 years, but he still thinks the Greater Depression is just around the corner.
So what is it that they're missing? If it's so obvious to you, what do you think the blockage is then? If it's a matter of, okay, let's do that. But then let's also deal with the average person listening to this wondering, do I belong in the stock market or not? And I think they think, I know if I just pile up cash in the bank, that's not a good long run idea because of inflation. But maybe I get into the stock market. Maybe my timing is wrong. And I get into the stock market just when Peter Schiff turns out to be right. That could be catastrophic for me. So how do you advise those people? And again, what is the insight that you have that other people just as formed by Austrian economics as you are don't seem to have?
So I had kind of an epiphany here in studying the Austrian theory of the business cycle. And by the way, I have a whole chapter in my book, A Viennese Waltz Down Wall Street. It's a compilation of my essays on this very issue. And my chapter in particular on Hayek and the Austrian theory of the business cycle is where I figured out what the problem was. So whenever I make a mistake in the marketplace, or whenever anyone makes a mistake in the investment area, they have to ask themselves this question: what am I missing? What am I missing? And unfortunately, that question is not asked enough among investment advisors. My answer is, what am I missing if you're a perma bear, is that you're looking at just the bust side, the bear side of the Austrian theory of the business cycle. Remember, the Austrian theory of the business cycle says that first you get an inflationary boom, and the inflationary boom can last for some time. So yes, it's artificial, but it's like blowing up a balloon. You can blow it up for a long period of time before it busts. And frankly, people have a hard time figuring out when that top is. I use an inverted yield curve as one of my strategies. That's been very helpful, but it's often difficult to figure out the timing when the bull market is going to top out and when the bear market bottoms out. Most people have not been able to do both. I have a hard time figuring out both. But the one thing I realized, well, why don't we invest in the inflationary boom phase and just use trailing stops? We just move up our stops so we get the vast majority of the profit on the upside, and then we get out when the market finally does tank. So this was my epiphany in realizing that good investors can play the inflationary boom phase. So in my book, A Viennese Waltz Down Wall Street, I talk about Jesus's parable of the wheat and the tares. And for those of you who are not familiar with this parable in Matthew, Jesus tells the story of where this farmer plants wheat, but then in the middle of the night, an enemy comes along and plants tares, that is weeds, alongside the wheat. So once they start growing, together, that you realize, wow, I have a bumper crop. I've got more, because initially you can't tell the difference between the tares and the wheat because there's no fruit yet. The fruit comes later. So it looks like you have a bumper crop, and the season lasts for months. And then eventually you see them growing together, and you have to separate the two, and you burn the tares, you burn the weeds, and then you put the wheat in the barn. So I love this parable because it does indicate that there is this period of time when you have both genuine prosperity, the wheat, and artificial prosperity, the tares or the weeds, growing together. And that's what happens to the stock market. So the stock market does get overvalued, but it stays overvalued for long periods of time. And then finally, when you have the burning, the crisis, and you have to separate the two, the stock market can fall in half. And that's what it's done. It did it. The NASDAQ fell in half in 2000, 2003. The stock market in general fell in half in 2008, 2009. So it does happen from time to time. And then it's a buying opportunity because the malinvestments have been eradicated. So if we focus on the boom phase, when the wheat and the tares grow together, that tends to last a lot longer. You know, there's an old saying on Wall Street that I have in the Maxims that says the stock market takes the stairs up and the elevator down. And that's, if you look at that chart I showed you, stock market, long periods of bull markets that can go for a dozen years. And then you have the collapse and that lasts for a year. And then it's over and then it starts building again. And that's been the pattern in the U.S. market now for ages.
Can you just, for the sake of the lay listener, explain what a trailing stop is?
So what you want to do, since this we're creating bubbles in the stock market, it's inflationary boom, whatever you want to call it, you simply, as the stock market heads higher, you put a stop order in place, maybe 20% below the market, because you always have corrections along the way. You don't want to get out if there's just a 10% correction. So let's say the stock market, the Dow is at 10,000, it goes to 15,000. Well, then you put a stop order in at, say, 12,000 on the Dow. And so if the stock market goes all the way down to 12,000, then you sell your position. So if the stock market goes to 20,000, you raise your stop order to, say, 16,000. So you have some leeway for small corrections, ripples, a few slumps in the marketplace, but you don't want to be in a position where you lose 50% of your net worth, especially if you're near retirement. So the stop orders, I think, are beneficial to kind of help us identify when the top of the market is.
All right. So in this bulls versus bears argument that's been going on, obviously, each of you are giving different kinds of advice to people. So you would have a different approach than, you know, let's say, well, Peter Schiff might be different because he's always had a particular fondness for non-U.S. markets. He's certainly not saying no stocks whatsoever. That's not his approach. But I know of, well, in fact, my friend Larry Lepard, who's been fairly successful, his view is he wants to have a little cash, some gold, some Bitcoin, and then some reliable stocks. And it seems to me you can't go wrong with that. But describe for me, what is the divergence in recommendations between somebody like you and somebody like a, you know, maybe a Doug Casey, or we don't have to name specific names, the general perma-bear strategy, if there is one?
Well, first of all, let me just say that a lot of these perma-bears they scare you to death in their promotional packages and when they speak at conferences. And it sounds like they're saying, get out of the market, don't be in the market. But then I talked to them individually and I said, so are you out of the market? And they say, no, I've got a position. And like you say, a bunch of these positions that they have. So don't listen to what they say. You got to listen to what they do. And a lot of times you don't know what they're doing. And I'm telling you, this is very common that you sell the fear factor. But when you actually invest with them, if you actually subscribe to their services, they're going to be recommending individual stocks. And it's probably going to be a fairly diversified portfolio in what you described as stocks, bonds, gold and silver and Bitcoin. And I have the same thing, although I don't have any bond positions per se, because I think you get better leverage with the stock market. So that's the first point that is really important, because being in a cash position, believe me, investors are going to not feel happy about that. It's burning a hole in their pocket. They're going to want to do something with it. What I get concerned about is when they encourage people to invest heavily. I never forget going to a New Orleans conference a couple of years ago, and after I gave my upbeat talk, I was surrounded by a number of professionals, lawyers, doctors, and so forth, who were at the conference. And I was mentioning that the stock market was the mother of all bull markets, and that we have we're at an all-time high. And they came up and said, well, we've lost 70% of our portfolio. And I said, how in the heck is that possible? And he said, well, we listened to all these gold bugs and we went out to the exhibit hall and we bought all these penny stocks and they're down 70%. What should we do? And I said, well, you're probably reached the bottom at this point. So might as well hold on. In fact, one guy did. And the next year he said, I'm up $1 million. So he was really happy about his decision to stick with it. You know, nothing's worse than buying at the top and then selling at the bottom. That's the worst thing that you can do. So my approach is, if people subscribe to my newsletter, Forecasts and Strategies, I'd like to think that I have learned from experience to be well-diversified and take advantage of trends. Know the signs of the times, as they say in the Bible. Know the signs of the times. You got to know the trends. And technology is where the big action is, whether it's Bitcoin or it's Tesla, electric cars, and so forth. And we have done really well. I mean, there's some ETFs out there that the technology spider fund, XLK, for example, that's the symbol, XLK, has Apple and Microsoft. 40% of their portfolio is in Apple and Microsoft. The Barron Partners Fund, which is another mutual fund that I like to take advantage and find money managers who are really good during a bull market. And Ron Barron is one of them, the Barron Partners Fund. He has a 41% position in Tesla. So it's my largest position in my IRA indirectly because I'm with the Barron Partners Fund. So that's, there's lots of different things that you can buy individual stocks. I think for most people buying ETFs that are well managed, by mutual funds like the Barron Partners Fund that I mentioned, well managed. They have a unique formula for making money during bull markets. And let's face it, in the U.S. market, most of the time stocks are going up. I'd say 3 out of every 4 trading days now, the stock market is rising in the U.S. That could end, but that's been the trend over the last 10 years.
Hey, everybody, let's thank our sponsor, BetterHelp. Let's face it, a lot of us had a really, really difficult 2020. And I think a lot of people looked forward to 2021 as a year when things would get a lot better for them. And frankly, that didn't work out for a lot of people. And a lot of people are still struggling with issues like depression and anxiety, which, if not brought on by 2020, were very likely exacerbated by it. And of course, there are still other issues that stand between you and happiness. Maybe you're struggling in your relationships, or you're having sleep problems, or trying to overcome trauma or grief. You've got problems within your family. All these kinds of things can be helped. And that's why BetterHelp exists. They'll match you up with your own licensed professional therapist. You can communicate with that person anytime you want through messages and, of course, through video or phone sessions. And just in case that counselor turns out not to be a perfect fit for you, you can get another one easily. It's convenient and affordable. You should check out the testimonials they post every day on their website. And in fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/woods. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/woods. Say a word about, you mentioned your book, A Viennese Waltz Down Wall Street. Can you give us a sense of what we're going to find in there? I mean, you talked about it a little bit, you made mention of it, but what was the thinking behind this book, that you were going to try to have the theory meet the practice?
Yeah, I think it's both a combination of theory, history, and practical advice. My idea was, you know, I teach a course on financial economics at Chapman University. I also taught it at Columbia Business School. And in this course, I looked at Burt Machiel's famous book, A Random Walk Down Wall Street. And I said to myself, well, that's not Austrian. That's not Misesian. Human action, it's a purposeful human behavior is what happens in the stock market. Behind stock prices are individuals who buy and sell based on rational decision making. So it's not random. It's not like a drunken sailor walking down Main Street or Wall Street. It's more like a dance. And so I like the dance symbol. I like the Viennese waltz symbol, although the stock market can often be a Tennessee waltz rather than a Viennese waltz. You know, if you've ever danced the Viennese waltz, which my wife and I have done a number of times when we've been in Vienna and elsewhere. It's a very fast dance. And stock markets, sometimes it's really fast, and other times it's Tennessee waltz. But it's a dance. And what do I mean by a dance? It's not random. You have certain rules to dance well. But within those rules, you can move around. You don't have to just do the same pattern again. But so I came up with the idea of writing a book called A Viennese Waltz Down Wall Street. It was published by Laissez-Faire Books a few years ago. I start off by talking about, well, what is Austrian economics? Because if you go to investment conferences at the Money Show or the New Orleans Conference, you'll see a number of speakers, including myself, talking about you need to understand the Austrian theory of the business cycle to understand the inflationary boom and bust that goes on. And so I decided to write a primer for investors specifically on what Austrian economics is all about. So I talk about the origins with, I have an individual chapter on Menger, the founder of the Austrian school, then von Barwerk, then Wieser and his great man theory, which I think is an important theory, then Mises and Hayek, Murray Rothbard, Israel Kirzner. And then I have the Austrian versus the Chicago school. I have a little chapter on that because the Chicago school, by the way, are optimists. Friedman and Stigler were optimists. They had big smiles on their face. I've also written a book called Vienna and Chicago, Friends or Foes. And I have on the cover of that one, the pictures of Mises and Hayek and they're stern and they're European and they're not smiling at all. They're pessimists. And then I have the pictures of Friedman and Stigler, and both of them are smiling and they're upbeat and they're optimistic.
Yeah, on the other hand, Rothbard was always smiling, even though he didn't have a lot of optimism, at least about the political short run. But he was always smiling and laughing. So I don't know if we can draw too many conclusions from this.
That's true. He was the happy warrior, as we know. But you got to remember with Murray Rothbard, he had a poison pen. And he can be smiling and everything. And then when he started writing, he could get into that attack mode. And boy, did he attack Reagan. He completely missed the benefits of Reaganomics.
Well, I mean, I must have done an episode on this at some point. I think in the long run, Reagan's a mixed bag. I mean, he certainly did some good things, but then sometimes the good things wound up being canceled out by not so good things. So it's okay to say, I want to judge your rhetoric by your actions. But I mean, if the budget doubled by the time he was out of there, and yeah, I know he had Democrats he had to deal with, but that's part of what you're supposed to do as a leader.
Yeah. No, I think what I like is focus on the marginal difference. You know, Austrian economics, their great contribution was marginal analysis, right?
Yeah.
Well, there was a marginal change between Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan, especially when it comes to monetary policy, because even though Jimmy Carter reversed himself, and he's the one who appointed Paul Volcker.
Yeah, right.
It was Reagan that kept him in office, and he made a big difference on monetary policy so that interest rates started declining starting in 1982. And then it was the beginning of this major bull market. And there were marginal changes in tax policy, marginal changes in deregulation. It wasn't a major change. And yes, there were mistakes that made on the way. I mean, we got TEFRA, which is a tax increase, and we got required minimum distributions. And we got the, in 1986, we had a tax, minimal alternative minimum tax. We had lots of things that were negative, but you have to do a cost-benefit analysis, right? You're an economist. Cost-benefit analysis, and the benefits exceeded the cost under Reagan, and that's pretty clear in the stock and bond markets, and even in economic growth. Economic growth was faster under Reagan than it was under Jimmy Carter. So it's just marginal changes. That's all you need to have a bull market.
I know you want to we want to direct people's attention to A Viennese Waltz Down Wall Street, which I will link to at tomwoods.com/2002. Is there anything else that you want to, you have your website with your newsletter. What else do you want to share with people?
Well, I think that the question I get most frequently is, how long can this mother of all bull markets last? In fact, I thought it was over with the in March of 2020, when the market suddenly dropped 30% in 1 month. That was, we were stopped out of a lot of positions. But when I looked at gross output, which, by the way, gross output is a, if there's anything else I would like to mention, my gross output statistic, GO, is extremely valuable because it does include the supply chain. GDP, which is a valuable statistic, macro statistic, leaves out the supply chain. And as you know, in today's world, the supply chain shortages is a very major issue. And gross output reversed itself. The supply chain reversed itself very quickly during the pandemic. And to me, that was a bullish sign. So we got back into the market right away, and we're benefiting as a result of that. So it's important to look at all of these new statistics, and gross output is one of them. I do have a website, grossoutput.com, if people want to learn more. But the federal government, you know, it kind of restored my faith in the federal government when they were rather early on adopting gross output, which I had recommended back in the Structure of Production book that came out in 1990. So it was nice to see in my lifetime the government adopting what I regard as the top line and bottom line in national income accounting. Top line meaning total sales at all stages of production, very much an Austrian statistic. It's a measure of Hayek's triangles. And I have to be honest with you, a number of Austrian economists have been very slow in picking up on the great breakthrough that gross output is. I thought everybody would immediately join forces in celebrating the quarterly release by the federal government of a top line of a Hayek's triangle measurement, but they haven't. And it's
I have, for what it's kind worth. I'm happy about it because, of course, it is a statistic we want. Because up to now, if we had asked for that statistic, we would have been told that we were, quote unquote, double counting.
Oh, yeah.
But it depends on what you're counting and what you're looking for, what you're trying to understand. And it is important to know what's going on at other stages of production. It's not just the finished consumer good. There's a whole lattice work here, and we need to know the health of all of it in order to understand what's going on.
Well, you are an enlightened economist, Tom. I congratulate you, because you're right. It's not just double counting, which is kind of a stumbling block with a lot of Austrians. I've heard this over and over again. What they don't understand is that the production process is moving along. It is changing the product. And even though it's double counting counts because there is a change either in location or the actual product itself. And businessmen are writing checks. They need to raise money for the full gross expenditures, not on just net income. So it's a technical issue among economists, but more and more private economists are looking at the supply chain, seeing what's happening. The shortages are very important in holding back an economy that could be growing pretty tremendously. So I guess the only other issue is, and I don't know if you wanted to discuss my outlook for the current market.
Yes, I was saying that before.
That?
Yeah. Before we went on, I was asking how would you feel about pivoting into that subject? I would love to get your assessment of the current situation.
So I do think we've had a very long period of inflationary boom, even starting with, since 2008, 2009, the real estate crisis. You know, that was a cleansing. There's no question about it. This is one thing I like about Murray Rothbard in his book, The Great Depression. He talks about the cleansing process that is so necessary, and you don't want to just keep inflating like crazy. Now, I do think that corporations came out of the Great Recession in pretty good shape. They built up a large cash position. They went on ruthless cost cutting. And so major corporations, I became quite bullish in 2009 when I realized that the cost cutting was very beneficial, that the economy was expanding. The Fed was, yes, injecting liquidity and trying to turn things around and so forth, thus creating another artificial boom. And again, the Austrians, traditional gold bugs, just looked at government stimulus and didn't look at what corporations were doing. We still had that entrepreneurial spirit. So we have entered a golden age of technology here with what's going on with Facebook, with Google, with Amazon, with electric cars and Tesla and all these kinds of things. And Bitcoin as well as an alternative currency to fiat money. So there's a lot of really exciting things going on. So I am still bullish. I'm still 100% invested, but obviously it's been a good more than 10 years of expansionary process. And it's a very delicate situation. We're building up for a crisis at some point. No question about that. That's clearly in the Austrian theory of the business cycle. So what are the signs that we're finally going to top out? So I'm 100% invested right now, but I'm using my stop orders just in case we top out. What I'm looking for is a resurgence of inflation, which we are having now. The second phase has to be rising interest rates. The Fed has kept interest rates artificially low. And so we're continuing to get this increase in the wheat and the tares. They're still growing together, but there's going to be a burning at some point. I think it's when the Fed is forced to raise interest rates and creates an inverted yield curve. Now, I don't think they have the guts right now to raise short-term interest rates longer than long-term rates, which is what an inverted yield curve is. T-bill rate is still under 1%. The 30-year treasury is at 2%. So you have a positive yield curve. So that's positive for the stock market. You have relative peace. You have easy taxes at this point. But suppose the Bidens really push up these taxes, increase regulations, create more instability in the marketplace. Perhaps a war breaks out. You can't dismiss what China is doing, where they're expanding their war machine. They're flexing their muscle. You could have an outbreak in the Middle East. All of these could cause the bull market to have a substantial correction, and we need to be alert to that. So that's my general assessment right now.
All right, one last thing then. Suppose there is a major correction. You're holding on to, let's say, a small array of stocks whose fundamentals you know to be sound. But let's say practically everybody gets hit by whatever tidal wave hits us. At that point, I could imagine somebody thinking, if I don't get out now, it could even get worse. But I could imagine other people thinking, but I know the fundamentals are sound. And if I don't need the liquidity immediately, then I should just hang on and wait for normal times to reappear. I guess it kind of depends on the specific stocks involved. But which of those two attitudes in general do you think is the better one?
So I like a quote from Dick Russell, the late Richard Russell, who wrote the Dow Theory Letters for over 50 years, passed away a few years ago. He said, in a bear market, he who wins is the man who loses the least. He who wins is the man who loses the least. So everybody loses in a bear market. Okay, there might be a few people who can smart enough to short the market, but given that bear markets are very short term, your timing has to be pretty good. And they always highlight a few people that have done well in that. But for most of us, we have a difficult time with that. I think your best strategy is a diversified portfolio, even today. So I would definitely have a position in gold and Bitcoin. I would definitely have a position, some position in cash. And use these stop orders in place so that with the high flyers that you made a ton of money on, don't get greedy. You might as well take a little bit off the table. But you never know when the market's going to turn around again. And so you want to have some position to take advantage of it and then start building your portfolio again once you reach that point. But there is an element of uncertainty here because a lot of it depends on your age. I mean, if you are retirement age and you're worried about running out of money, you can't really afford a 50% decline in your portfolio. So you might want to be more conservative in that sense. And there is the permanent portfolio fund that Harry Brown created many years ago. The permanent portfolio fund has I think it's a little bit out of date because they have 25% in stocks, 25% in bonds, 25% in gold and silver, and 25% in cash. And I'm not sure that's the best portfolio you can have for a permanent portfolio that will protect you to some extent on the downside. You're still going to lose money, just lose less money. So you need to have an attitude that you're not going to be able to protect your entire portfolio. You're going to lose some money. Nobody's perfect in this business, but if you can minimize those risks. The other thing I like are dividend paying stocks that have paid dividends for 50 years or longer. There are a lot of these kinds of companies that have a rising dividend policy. I mean, Enterprise Products Partners, EPD is the symbol. This is a pipeline company that I've been recommending for years. And they're yielding 8%. And they've never cut their dividend in their 30 some years in history. And they've had a rising dividend most of that time. So it cushions the fall. The dividend paying stocks are going to decline like everything else. But meanwhile, you're going to get paid a nice dividend. So that's another way that you can kind of hedge yourself and minimize your losses during a bear market.
All right. All good advice, which I have myself been following lately. So I'm glad to have this chance to talk to you, especially because I've featured a lot of people who look at things a very different way from you. So I want to give folks listening an opportunity to hear both sides of this conversation. So I'm going to have quite a bit of Mark Skousen material up at tomwoods.com/2002. We're going to link you over there to Viennese Waltz Down Wall Street, but also to Forecasts and Strategies, Mark's newsletter, and the gross output stuff. It'll all be there, tomwoods.com/2002. Well, thanks again, Mark. Let's do it again soon.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Okay, everybody. Remember, if you missed the 2000th episode, you got to watch it. Okay. It's no substitute to listen to. You got to watch it. And if it's blocked in your country because of copyright reasons, because I have some copyrighted music in there and I am not taking it out, then just watch it on my Odyssey channel. That's why I have it. So that's tomwoods.com/vid, V-I-D. Get you over to my Odyssey channel. You can find the 2000th episode there, just as good as on YouTube. I posted all the videos. They're all embedded, YouTube and Odyssey. It's in two parts, and you can find them all at tomwoods.com/2000. tomwoods.com/2000. And you're just going to love it. It was a ton of fun. It was great, very entertaining. Seriously, I'm not kidding. Make some popcorn. Make an evening out of it. Put it up on your TV screen, and you're just going to love it. You're going to feel like you're there, and you're going to be inspired by all the energy in the room, and I dare say you're going to be mightily entertained. So check it out, tomwoods.com/2000. Another evening of entertainment, courtesy of Old Woods here. All right, I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.